What are the vital interests of the United States that justify the presence of 500,000 troops in Vietnam and the expenditure of $25 billion or more annually for the war in Vietnam?
May I just say before we go into this question period, I'm a give and take fellow. I know that there are panelists here that have received questions all across the state, which I would have thought my friends might have shared with me a little more generously. But I don't want anybody to think for a single minute that these are patsy questions. And when we get through a rundown of a question here, I want to take them from the audience. I have another hour and another good hour to be with you. So you just don't hesitate. You ask any question you want to. Now, your question, I believe, was
interests of the United States to justify the presence of 500,000 troops in Vietnam and the expenditure of $25 billion or more annually for the war.
Well, I believe that in part that question was answered in my prepared remarks, which are remarks that I feel are relevant and to the point. I believe that President Kennedy himself made it quite clear that we had a great vital interest in terms of our own national security in Vietnam as it related to Southeast Asia, because Southeast Asia is a very critical part of the world. It's an area of over 200 million people. The fifth largest nation in the world is in that area, Indonesia. It represents Vietnam itself is at the mouth of the Mekong Delta, the Mekong River. And the Mekong River has stood there for centuries, unused, untapped in terms of its resources. And right now, that Mekong River is being developed, even as this war goes on, to provide water power, to control floods, to lift the standard of living for peoples in Thailand, in Cambodia, in Laos, in Malaysia, in Vietnam, the whole area. So I'd put it this way, that our interests in Vietnam, our interests there are significant to our own national security. The commitment that we've made, of course, is to the independence of South Vietnam and its freedom from attack. We happen to believe, as I said earlier, that it is much better to meet the attack of the aggressor when it can be contained, when it does not be in danger or bring on the danger of world conflagration. I do not believe, as I said to you in Armageddon, in the installment plan, I think that the loss of Vietnam, as was said by President Kennedy, would stimulate the ambitions of the communists in that part of the world, which are very militant, expansionist, dynamic, would whet their appetite. The loss of Vietnam would surely encourage those forces to move further. Then I would say this, that the leaders of countries like Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, the Philippines, Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Laos, just to mention a few, all seem to feel, as Prime Minister Lee of Singapore said, that our presence in Vietnam gives free Asia time to remain free and develop their own capacity to be free. Now let me just give one other observation on it. I want you to ponder this for a moment. What do you think would happen in this world if the United States of America, having made a solemn treaty commitment of mutual assistance, were to violate that treaty? Let me just take you to another part of the world. What do you think would happen in Western Europe tomorrow if the United States publicly announced that our stand in Berlin wasn't worth it? And by the way, Berlin is much more indefensible from our point of view, much more dangerous than Saigon. It's 100 miles inside communist territory. It's a divided city. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, I have yet to hear a prominent American of either party say that the United States of America should not fulfill its commitment to Berlin. One of the first acts of President Kennedy in 1961 was to call up 250,000 reserves, send 50,000 additional Americans to Europe for the defense of Berlin. And because he did it, and did it promptly, and because the Soviet Union is a responsible a power that recognizes the responsibility and recognizes our power. The Soviet Union did not press its case. But the day that we fail to fulfill our commitments, it's on that day that the world has the signal that the aggressor has free hunting. So I believe that our commitment in South Vietnam is vital to our national interests. I think it's vital to world peace. Our objective there is to find, to help build a world of peace. I think that South Vietnam has a strategic importance in Asia. And if you were in Australia and New Zealand, countries with which we have alliances, if you were in Malaysia or Indonesia, countries today that face communist attack at every minute, you would understand the importance of our commitment of some 500 troops, 1,000 troops in Vietnam, and as Mr. Farr has said, an expenditure of around $25 billion or more annually in that struggle. By the way, the money is not the painful thing. It's costly in money, but what really is tragic about this war is the loss of human life. That's what bothers us. This is a rich country, but a country is never rich enough to lose its men. It's necessary sometimes, but that is a tragic loss. And can I say this to my fellow Democrats? If you want peace, and I know you do, just imagine how much your president wants it. Just let that sink in for a moment. Just keep in mind that the President of the United States has to bear the awful burden of having committed men to battle. Just keep in mind that the President of the United States is pilloried from one end of this country to another because of his position on Vietnam. On every grounds, the most selfish and the most noble, the leader of our country wants peace more than any man that I can think of, and he will walk the extra mile to get it. But we think we have learned some lessons. We doubt that there would be peace if you gave up in Vietnam. I know that the Prime Minister of Malaysia told me less than a month ago. He said, Mr. Vice President, I have but one question to ask you. Are you going to stay put in Vietnam? Because he said, if you are not, then there is no hope for Malaysia. All of our effort goes for naught. For 12 long years, Mr. Vice President, we fought the communists. And he pointed, as if you please, the Deputy Prime Minister pointed out into a field, and he said, in that very field, Mr. Vice President, a member of my family was assassinated by the communists. He said, we know what it is. But if the United States of America is going to back away, if you're going to lessen in your, if you're going to relax your resolve, then you can write off all of Southeast Asia. What do you think that would mean to China? I mean to India. What do you think it would mean to the Philippines? What do you think it would mean to Australia? And I must say that I was intrigued not long ago when a very fine American and a man whose friendship I valued over the years said that he thought that our defense line ought to be in Australia. The Prime Minister of Australia said, if you don't mind, we'd like to pick the place where we'd prefer to do our own fighting. And I want to ask you, what is more moral about fighting in Australia than fighting in Vietnam? What's more moral about it? One of the purposes of this nation, my fellow Democrats, and my fellow citizens, has been nation building. I think it is downright immoral to let the weak be overwhelmed by the brutes. And I think it's downright... And I think it's dangerous and foolhardy for us to assume that by letting a force of aggression, of totalitarianism, absorb one part of the world, that it will be satisfied. I see nothing in history to justify it. Next, Ms. Kane.
Mr. Vice President, the members of the DFL Policy Advisory Committee ask you to look at our interests in Vietnam from quite a different standpoint. They ask, do our interests in Vietnam justify the diversion of resources and the attention of our national leaders from our most urgent domestic problems.
I think that our interests in Vietnam and our commitments there under treaty, under the Charter of the United Nations, under CETO, under our mutual assistance guarantees, do justify our position in Vietnam. That's number one. I regret that we have to divert resources to any kind of military buildup. All of my life, I have worked for a kind of sensible program of disarmament. The author of the Disarmament Agency, one of the co-authors of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. I think one of the tragedies of our time is the awful utilization, the vast utilization of resources and men in weaponry. But sometimes we're not given a choice. So to face up to the realities of Vietnam, we're spending about 9% of our gross national product today, my fellow Americans, 9% of our GNP on our total defense bill. In 1958, we spent 10%. So in terms of whether we can afford it monetarily, as I said earlier, that is not the question. The question is, do we have the will and the determination to see it through? Now, what about the other programs? I know this argument is made repeatedly, that if we weren't in Vietnam, we'd be doing so many other things. Well, I was in Congress when the war was over in Korea. And when that war was over in Korea, even with a Democratic Congress, my fellow Americans, we reduced the taxes, we had no war on poverty, we had no Medicare, we had no expanded education program. In fact, what we did was cut back. Now, there were more poor in America in 1956 than there are in 1966 and 1967. There were old people in America that had poor health care in the 1950s, but they had no health program. Now, what has this administration done? This administration has increased our investments in federal aid to education from 1960, where they stood at $3 billion, to $12.2 billion in 1967. This administration has increased our investments in health care from 1963 from $4.5 billion to over $9 billion in 1967. I think that we have demonstrated that we are concerned about needs on the home front. And then, to put it just another way, we're having a mighty difficult time getting some things through the Congress right now that are as modest as a $40 million rent supplement bill. A $40 million rent supplement bill. And I doubt that that rent supplement bill would slip through any easier if we had a smaller defense budget. I'll tell you what happened to the Congress. It wasn't Vietnam. It was that we lost 47 seats in 1966. That's what happened in Congress. So my answer to you, Mrs. Kane, is that while the resources we have to devote to our defense and to this struggle in Vietnam are substantial, that we have also been able to mobilize resources in this country for some of the greatest social endeavors that America has ever known, opening doors of opportunity that have been locked shut for better than a century. We have made some very substantial breakthroughs. And here's what I want to ask this party. This war will be over. And pray God it'll be over very, very soon. I cannot predict, nor shall I predict. But I want to make this prediction to you, that when this struggle is over, then the political struggle on the home front will be something to talk about and to be concerned about. Because then there will be the cutback artists. Then there will be those that say, oh, you can't go too fast and too far. There will be those that say we ought not to spend for this and for that. As a matter of fact, you'll have the fight of your life. And I hope that when this struggle is over and I get my sign, and I'll be out here picketing a bit, when I put my sign up and say, follow me for a doubling of our aid to federal aid to education. Follow me for the doubling or more of our aid to our cities. I hope I have a party behind me that's united and that'll win elections on that issue. that'll be quite a struggle. I've been around. Congressman Blotnick.
Mr. Vice President, from the Policy Advisory Committee, and a question that I also would have submitted, is not the failure of the South Vietnamese to do more, in fact, much more for themselves, including fighting in their own defense, evidence of the unpopularity of our cause in South Vietnam?
Well, this is a matter that is a grave concern to our people. It's a question that I think merits, Congressman Blotnick, a detailed answer, and I'm going to try to give it to you the best of my ability. We've discussed these things privately. I want to refresh your memory for a minute. There are men in this room that were veterans of the Korean War. What did we say about that Korean army at that time? I don't want to say it from the public platform as a vice president because things are always misinterpreted. But I sure think you ought to think it through. We weren't very complimentary. And there was grave doubt expressed time after time in the American press from quotations of prominent American officials and others as to whether we ought to even be in Korea. In fact, the Korean army was less than a good fighting force. The government was corrupt. There were a half a dozen, in fact, many more than a half a dozen coups, military coups. And we were practically driven out. But we stayed. And today, the Korean army is one of the most combat effective military establishments in the world. Today in Korea, it has a miracle of economic breakthrough. Today in Korea, there are free elections. Today in Korea, there's a great expanded program of education. Korea stands today as a monumental success. But I venture to say, if you go to your Minneapolis library or your local library and take a look at the papers 10 years ago, you'll read the following. Korea, America's massive mistake. Korea, a hopeless mess. 1957 headlines. This is 1967. I attended the inaugural of President Park of Korea. I saw a nation on the move. And I saw a nation today that can give a good accounting of itself, that's taking leadership all over Asia in regional economic and social development. Now let's take a look at Vietnam. Vietnam has suffered 1,000 years of Mandarin rule, 100 years of French colonialism, which surely didn't help it. Vietnam has had 27 years of struggle since 1940. Since 1964, 58,000 Vietnamese, exclusive of their civilians in their villages, their village chiefs and leaders that have suffered from terroristic attacks and assassination of the Viet Cong, 58,000 of their regular army have died on the field of battle. Now, if you translate that into proportionate terms relating to the American population, that's equivalent to 850,000 fatalities. We have presently lost 15,000. The number of wounded, seriously wounded, and they do not call wounded those who get their hand caught in a door, but battle wounded, if translated into American terms in proportion to population, would be over 2 million. This country has 1 out of every 6 male adults in its armed services. Right now, it has a military establishment of over 700,000 men, and it's putting 65,000 more men in uniform January 1968. It's lowered the draft age to 18. The desertion rate, which was high, and which is something that many of our critics talked about, was very high, has been cut in half. And during the last few months, under the direction of General Abrams, whom my friend the Congressman knows, one of our most capable military officers, an intensive program of training in modern guerrilla warfare has been instituted, and that army is doing a better job. While I was in Saigon, the ARVN, that is the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, gave smashing defeats on 3 occasions to the North Vietnamese forces within 20 and 30 kilometers of Saigon. We intercepted documents from the North Vietnamese that called upon the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong to intensify their attacks, even suicidal attacks, starting with the inaugural of the President and the Vice President of the Republic of Vietnam. I ought to know I was within 75 yards of a mortar attack on the presidential palace on the night of the inaugural reception. The Army of the Republic of Vietnam is good in some areas, poor in others. In the demilitarized zone, its battalions and its companies and its brigades are fighting brilliantly. I decorated the officers of the Airborne Battalion and the DMZ. General Walt of the Marine Corps said he came back to the United States. The man who was in charge of the First Corps area in the northern part of Vietnam came back and said, I couldn't believe what I was reading. He says, Mr. Vice President, he said, it's nothing short of a national tragedy that the facts are not being reported properly on the Army of North Vietnam, of South Vietnam. So, let me just put it this way. There's much improvement needed yet in the Arvon, much, as it was in the armies of Korea. There's much improvement that yet needs to be taken in the government and in the pacification. We have to be honest with each other. This is a country that has been terrorized for years. But let me give you the record. Five free elections since September 1966. In a country torn by war, no other country that's been involved in a war on its territory has held free elections. They've always had a sort of an emergency period with no elections. This government, this country, at our request and at our insistence and with our cooperation and their firm purpose, held an election of a constituent assembly to write a constitution. And the cynics said it never would happen, but it did. And when the assembly was elected, they said that it would be a mouthpiece for Key, but it wasn't. And they said if it wrote a constitution that the military directorate would never accept it, but it did. And then they said when they wrote the constitution and if it was accepted, there would never be an election, but there was. Now, my fellow Americans, I'm not here to tell you that those elections were pure. Obviously, there are discrepancies. There have been some discrepancies in elections even in the state of Minnesota. But I will say this, that there's been more elections in South Vietnam than North Vietnam. And I will say this. We ought to encourage people that hold elections, and we ought not to downgrade it. Now, what else? The pacification program. When I was there in February 1966, and that was my first experience, and I like to use that as a base point. I don't claim to be an expert in these matters. But in February 1966, they were talking about a pacification program. They were talking about revolutionary development. They were talking about training young people to go on out and rebuild their country, talking about it. There wasn't a single cadre, a single person trained. I was there in this year, in November 1967, and I went to the training center, and there have been 30-some thousand revolutionary development cadre trained and sent back into the villages and hamlets to help develop local self-government, which the French had destroyed, to help develop their economy, to rebuild their villages. And by the end of this coming year, there'll be 75,000 of them that'll provide a political base for their country. In the meantime, the government of Vietnam has just ordered the military leaders, colonels, captains, generals, to attend the same training school so they get a political indoctrination of the new purpose of Vietnam, have ordered the hamlet chiefs and the province chiefs to go to this training school. I think they're making sacrifices. They've kept their inflation under reasonable control. And there is tremendous development that's taken place in this country in the agricultural areas. 360-some cooperatives have been organized in the last 2 years in rural cooperatives. The first rural electric, the first REA in Southeast Asia has been established in South Vietnam. 7,000 new classrooms have been built. The enrollment of children in elementary and secondary education is up 300%. For the first time, the children of South Vietnam have textbooks in their schools. And it's all been done under terms of war. I wish more were done. I wish that there'd be greater progress. I wish that it was all over. I can only tell you this, that the best way to get it over is to encourage these people, to give them a pat on the back when they do a good job, and to demand of their government, as we are, that they rid their country as much as it is humanly possible of corruption. And corruption is a very serious problem in every Asian country. I might mention to you that most countries that have gone through a colonial experience do not come out of it very pure. Colonial powers did not always develop a sense of civic responsibility amongst the people. This country is beginning to see its way. And with our help and the help of others, I think it'll find its way. Thank you, Jerry.
Mr. Vice President, this question also comes from the Policy Advisory Committee, and we have been using them because they struck us as being so basic. They seem to cover a good many of the questions that have been sent to us to ask you by individuals. This question is our current military strategy consistent with our aims in Vietnam? In particular, is it not apparent that our bombing of North Vietnam is no longer serving any useful purpose, but may be hardening the resolve of North Vietnam against a negotiated settlement?
That committee sure did a good job. I think I read something about those items in the paper. Those are very thoughtful questions. Well, what is our current military strategy? What is its main purpose, its main objective? Well, it's to assist the South Vietnamese, to assist South Vietnam to defend itself against armed attack. That's number one. And to meet and to destroy the mainline units of the enemy of North Vietnam and the Viet Cong. That's number one. Number two, our military strategy is to aid in securing the area, not only to seek and destroy, or to search and destroy, but to take and to hold. That's what we call pacification. That's a very unfortunate word. There's nothing very pacific about pacification. The Army of Vietnam, about half of which is now assigned to pacification, finds itself under vicious attack. This is security of the village, security of the countryside. So we have two, I would say, our military strategy consists of two objectives: to provide security vital to the pacification process, that's number one, to continue to drive the enemy and main force units back out of the country into areas of refuge or into the mountain and jungle regions. Now, those are the two military objectives. In 1965, I think it's fair to say that the tide of battle was incontrovertibly with the Viet Cong. Today, the tide of battle is incontrovertibly, uncontestably with the Allies, with Vietnam, the United States, and our allies. There isn't any doubt about it. North Vietnam and the Viet Cong have no more chance of winning this war than any of you have a chance of being the first person on Mars. They can't win militarily, but this is not just a military war. This war is essentially a political struggle. And therefore, our military objectives are designed, in a sense, to fulfill political commitments and political objectives, namely to provide a solid social, economic, and political base in South Vietnam for their own self-determination and their own development. Now about the bombing, the most controversial matter of all. And may I say, in all respect to those who have disagreed on the bombing, there's honest argument on this bombing question. I'm not a military expert. The main argument that we have about the bombing is that North Vietnam demands, as a price for the possibility, the elusive hope of which we see very little reality, the price of our unconditional, permanent cessation of the bombardment of the North, and then possibly, maybe, hopefully, they might talk. And we have said that that condition was beyond what we consider to be our vital interests. Now, the bombing of North Vietnam has never been considered an alternative to ground war, or has never been considered a substitute for a war in the South. I know there's been a lot of loose talk about bombing on both sides. The purpose of the air power in North Vietnam is twofold. One, to slow down infiltration of men and material, and secondly, to make it abundantly clear to the North Vietnamese themselves that they have to pay a price for this aggression upon the South.